You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello and welcome to episode 47 of Tea Break Archaeology. I'm Matilda Siebrecht, and this is part two of our Tea Break with Svenja, talking all about ancient Rome gladiators and gladiatorial training. So we talked a little bit last episode about kind of your experience with getting into reenactment and some kind of myth busting about gladiatorial fights. But in terms of like the topic of ancient Rome, so you mentioned that that's how you first got into reenactment. But did you have a background in history or in archaeology? Was it just sort of a personal interest in the topic? What got you interested in the broader topic and theme of ancient Rome?
No, it was actually just I don't have any academic background. Neither am I an archaeologist nor historian. So it was purely, yeah, my interest. And yeah. I had this since I was a kid. I was reading the Asterix books, which
excellent.
Are very popular in Germany.
And very academically accurate, I can imagine.
Not that much, but it's surprisingly with them, some things I find kind of like accurate, which surprises me for a comic book.
Yeah.
And of course, other things, you know, it's not accurate. But what I was always fascinated back then with the like how the Romans had organized their camps and these things. Mm. Of course, each camp was run by a centurion, but no, it would have been the prefectus castrorum.
That's all, okay.
So yeah, yeah. Now you see, it's just they picked maybe a well-known rank of the military. Yeah. But anyhow, I liked it how they portray their this accuracy of the Romans and this kind of more like audit goals.
Yeah. Anything when you're trying to like organize a large group is bound to be slightly more chaotic. Yeah. But no, but that's really interesting.
Yeah, then it actually was triggered again by the movie Gladiator in 2000.
Ah, okay.
So and eventually I had to. Once I got more and more into that topic of also of ancient Rome, I had to find out how inaccurate this movie actually is. So it used to be really my favorite movie because I really like the plot and the atmosphere the movie is creating, also with this very good soundtrack.
Yeah.
But nowadays, since I know so much about Rome and also especially gladiators, because they are completely wrongly portrayed there, I cannot watch this movie anymore.
Yeah, that's like, so actually, for those listening in, both Svenja and I are part of the Archaeo Book Club. So that's one of the ways that we know each other. And we were talking about this, I think, in some other one where we were both reading a book that we'd read when we were younger and loved. But then when you read it from like an analytical archaeological perspective, it's like, oh, it just doesn't work anymore. I think it was
I think it was timeline.
Yeah, timeline. Yeah, we were going, this isn't accurate.
Yeah, and still for me, like timeline, because that was a medieval period. I don't know.
It's far enough away.
But of course, the way the people act there, it was also kind of annoyed.
Yeah, exactly. But so let's return to what we do know, what you do know now about this. So, and you mentioned that you got into the sort of gladiatorial reenactment side because you already had experience with kind of martial arts and martial fighting sports and that kind of thing. So how do we know about, we were talking a bit last episode about the fights themselves and the different roles people would have had and all that kind of thing. But how did they actually train for their fights? Like, did they also have like sport coaching sessions or like practice sessions?
Yeah, unfortunately, that is not very well known because we don't have much literature about this. There's only one Roman military historian, Vegetius. I would pronounce him now in German. I don't know how he would be pronounced.
To be fair,
And he wrote Militaris. Yeah, that's like kind of a handbook for military.
Yeah.
And there he explained that especially the newbies that they trained against an palus, this thing is called in Latin. Uh-huh. It's like a 2 meter high pole and they need to train their sword thrusts against this thing.
Okay.
And even mentioned that this was also the basic training for gladiators.
Okay.
So that there was really an overlap to really learn weapon fightings with this pole as a training tool.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that we know. And it actually makes sense because you need to learn, the mensur, they call it in fencing, really the distance which you need to have in order to be out of range or come into range.
Yes.
And of course, then also handling a sword and a shield, which you could add, also training. Then you could also add train more the accuracy of your thrusts. Then you can also train your stamina, that you say you need to do it very quick until you are completely out of breath and something, hold and then do it again and something like this. So this simple thing, you can train several things with it.
Yeah. And do we have material evidence of these as well? Like, have they found... What did you mention? Palos?
It's just a pole. It's just wood. And you as an archaeologist know what happens with wood.
Wood is the bane of most archaeologists' existence because it does not survive.
Yeah, but there are some depictions of it on reliefs or something that... On a gravestone where gladiator carved in a relief, I think it's a secutor. He's standing next to the pole, and on the top of the pole is his helmet. So that's why you know that he's a secutor.
It's like modern CGI in films. Yeah. They just pop like a tennis ball on the top of the pole to show that that's where you need to look.
Yeah. And so that's where they know
where
about
they get
it
from.
Or identified this as what is described in this text.
Okay. And do they also talk about, I assume if it's a wooden pole, that they're also not hacking at it with metal swords, because I guess it would just get destroyed the whole time.
Yeah, she was also described that in the beginning they used wicker shields.
Oh, okay.
And also wooden swords, which were supposed to be heavier than the real one. Yeah, with the wicker, I can imagine. I've seen one of the legionary groups where my husband is a member of.
Right.
They have those wicker shields, so I lifted one up, and indeed it's a little bit heavier than...
It is heavier. That's funny. I would have imagined it would have been lighter for some reason.
Yeah, it is heavier.
Okay, interesting. Oh,
but also with the wooden sword, I didn't know. Yeah, of course, we use nowadays in reenactment, of course, swords with... Not with the cutting edge very thin.
Right.
Of course, we don't want to cut anyone.
Yeah.
That's why it has to
have
this
certain
thickness.
I think if you're being authentic, Svenja, you need to get
into it. Yeah, and that's why, because it needs to be, of course, thicker.
Yeah.
That's why, of course, the whole sword is heavier. You have more material on your sword. So for us nowadays, it sounds really weird that a wooden sword might be heavier than a metal sword. But if you have really a sharp metal sword where less material is sitting on than on my reenactment sword, then of course it could be. But then of course those two training equipments, shield and sword, are much larger, heavier, unwieldier than the real stuff. But maybe that's also to train you to get used to more weight, because then when you pick up the real stuff, it feels, this is light. Oh.
I mean, that's actually, I'm just thinking, I just keep referring this back to my swimming trainings. That's also a swimming training. You use paddles to sort of do a bit of to make yourself heavier, or you use things, you have to swim in your clothes or something. And it's sort of, then when you stop doing that, then it's suddenly oh my goodness, I can fly. I can fly through the water. So I suppose it's similar. I'm also trying to remember, I did sword fighting for one semester at uni back in the day, because they were offering it as part of the sports club. And I was like,
what did you do? This typical
it was the medieval one
where they rely on the medieval books.
And it was so, but oh my goodness, I mean, you were just talking about these swords, and when you first pick them up you think, oh yes, it's fine, it's not that heavy. Try doing 2 hours of constant moving this sword around, and oh my goodness, it's a lot of work. So I can imagine using a clunkier one for training than when you're actually in the fight, it's a lot easier, I suppose, to lift these things up.
Yeah, but I assume they also should have practiced with the real things more or less, or with the blunt sword.
Yeah.
To really have the feeling for the dimensions.
For the weight, true.
Things.
Yeah. Because otherwise you might go for something and you will like trip over because it's not as heavy as you're expecting, which, that's really interesting. And in terms of, I mean, we've already talked about that they got food and everything. I mean, would they have had a specialized diet? I mean, a lot of people at this time of year, you know, trying to think about eating more healthily and everything. Was there a kind of fad for following the gladiatorial diet in Roman society?
Actually, there was a diet, and the Dr. Alan Galenos, he wrote about it. He was at a gladiator school and observed the gladiators, how they behaved and what they did. And he recommended the diet, and it was with lots of proteins. They ate barley as the basis. You're making a pulse with barley. So eating pulse was a general thing that's kind of a porridge. That was like for every
like
Roman,
sort of,
the basic thing. But what it consisted of, gladiators had barley, but because that was the cheapest thing and you had to feed whatever, I don't know how many hundred men and maybe also women were at a gladiator school, you also had to consider the staff, which was attached to Eldudos. So that was the cheapest thing. But that's another misconception, that they got fat from it. Of course, they didn't.
Yeah.
That's another article I wrote about debunking that myth.
Okay, nice. We're putting, by the way, if people want to read any of these articles, check the show notes, because I've linked the academia page. So all of these articles will be in there.
Yeah, I can imagine that also if you eat only every day the same, you get bored and not happy from it. So I can assume that gladiator schools, when the whoever was responsible for the food went to the market, also bought what was on sale on the market. One day it was carrot,
like
the other
Fridays.
Day it was maybe a little bit fish, then the other day it was kind of meat and different vegetables or whatsoever.
Yeah.
So that they also put a variety in it to put it into this basic porridge.
Yeah. Nice. And I mean, because we've talked about gladiator schools and stuff a bit, and how a lot of these, you know, you had to specialize in particular roles, you had to specialize in fighting men versus animals or versus with a sword versus a trident and all this kind of thing. So it's quite a specialized training as well, I can imagine, although you said that they're sort of similar to soldiers. But I mean, could anyone have trained with gladiators? Like, you didn't have to be a gladiator, but you could go to like the gladiator gym, or was it only for gladiators?
There was some other institution where they received kind of sword training.
Okay.
It's called Collegium Juvenum. So that was more for the youth, but also based on some inscriptions, it was also for boys and girls.
Oh,
and
nice.
They learned the sword fighting athletics, but they also learned at those things, theater, rhetoric, and these things.
So it's like a youth club, after school
youth
club. Yes,
kind of a youth club. And there, sometimes they also appeared, presented their sword fighting or something.
Okay.
And this inscription from Ostia, it's not 100% clear if where those gladiators, those female gladiators came from, if they were recruited from this youth club, because he was also the head of this youth club, and that it could have been a show which he put in his inscription, which he put on for his youth club, so that the whole youth club presented a show, which would have also been a possibility.
Okay. So they might not necessarily have been official gladiators necessarily.
Yes.
It was more trained in some sort of sword fighting and athletics and things, but from the youth club.
Like I said before, if someone, you could hire always as a volunteer gladiator, you could always go to a Lannister and say, hey, I want to become a volunteer.
Yeah.
And but we still need to kind of remember that it was kind of like a disgraceful to really appear as a gladiator.
Yeah.
And that also meant that you receive prize money for it.
Right.
Even though the Lannister might have kept some of it and you got only a portion, but still, once you got prize money for it, you appeared publicly as a gladiator And then you became disgraced.
Okay. So you almost wanted to do it as sort of the fun training side of things, almost like play acting, being a gladiator, but not actually yes. being a gladiator, not getting the disgrace of it.
Oh, I mean, wow. There have been toy swords found. Ah. So we don't know what the Roman kids played. Did yeah. they play soldier or did they play gladiator? Ooh. Or maybe both?
That would be a good time travel question, you know, to see.
Definitely.
Well, we're going to have a very quick break to top up our tea, but we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. Time for the last section of our chat with Svenja. So thank you so much, Svenja, for sharing all of this experience and knowledge about gladiators with me. I feel like I've learned a lot, but maybe we can learn a little bit more specifically about the reenactment side of things, because you were mentioning that it's changed a lot, but that still it's kind of the field of reenactment is still relatively unknown, I would say. I mean, do you think that it's sort of become more popular since you started in general, the sort of general field rather than gladiatorial training specifically?
I have the feeling that most people are still thinking more about those medieval markets.
Yeah.
And when I was still, very often people say when they see some medieval market, hey, isn't that something for you? And I say, why? It's medieval.
Yeah.
I'm reenacting Roman times. So yeah. that's for a lot of people, that's still the only way where they have any connection to reenactment is yeah. those medieval markets.
Yeah. That's, I mean, to be fair, that's very similar to like people will say to me, oh, and you know, what's your favorite Roman emperor? And I go, I don't know. I don't really know any because I don't study ancient Rome. But so, you know, what do you think of this Egyptian pharaoh? And you're going, oh, I really couldn't say. But do you have, I mean, if in case people are listening in and thinking, you know, this sounds really interesting, it sounds really fascinating. Is there kind of more than one way to get into the field of, I suppose, then ancient Roman reenactment?
Yeah, it always depends on what you want to do. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the best thing is always to do your research first before starting buying something or creating something. And of course, if some people, they really don't like to be attached to a club or whatsoever,
yeah,
they really want to do something independent. Of course, for those, it would help always a lot. Yeah, do first research and maybe just check on, I don't know, Facebook or whatsoever, on some pages where a lot of reenactors are located, or check on Exarch.
I was about to say, check the Exarch Discord.
And yeah, exactly. And finding there some people being interested in the same field.
Yeah.
And yeah, for Roman reenactment, of course, there are also a lot of groups which you could join. And if you join a group or say you are interested, you don't need to have all equipment already.
Yeah.
Then it's also the group which could help you finding the correct equipment,
right, and yeah.
the correct material to use and these yeah. things, and where to buy it and these things. And for, like, if you say, yeah, as a civilian, of course, you will need to make your own clothes, but then also the group could help you also with the sources, where to buy the material and things,
yeah.
and not going to IKEA and buy something there.
Yeah.
And also with the correct pattern, how to cut or sew a thing.
Yeah.
Because it's less cutting than modern sewing for Roman reenactment. And like I said earlier with the Strophium, that yeah, maybe I should write something for the Exarch blog about it. How I found out how to wrap this thing.
It is. I mean, it's really interesting. I find that really fascinating. Maybe you should write it for the blog, because then it's like a shorter, more sort of fun thing. Look out for that, people. Maybe Sandy will have written it by the time this comes out. I'll send the link.
And yeah, if you want to be like portray a Roman soldier, then there are of course tons of legionary groups, and they have also of course equipment from the group which belongs to the group, and they can also help you once you want to buy your own equipment, which what would be suitable and what not, and all these things. And nowadays there are more manufacturers around producing helmets, swords, and these things on a better level than it was like 20 years ago.
Hmm.
20 years ago, there was especially this one factory or whatever from India where you bought the things.
Okay.
Or distributor, it was. They weren't accurate. They looked kind of like it, but you could not use them. Either helmets were too big, too small, something.
Yeah.
And nowadays there are enough of like crafts people manufacturing helmets really after your own measurements. You have to give them certain measurements from your head, not the circumference alone, but also whatever length of head, this, that, that.
Yeah, yeah.
So that, of course, that costs more money than something ready-made, but even ready-made things are today in a better quality than it used to be 20 years ago, because there are other manufacturers also in India nowadays.
Huh.
And they work together now with different distributors, and those people look more after the accuracy. That's also makes things much easier. And sometimes you have amazing people even within a group who can do these things. Like in my gladiator group in Hamburg, there's this one guy, he did a belt, which is still more or less the more easier part. And then he also did a greave. So, and now he's trying to make a helmet. I think it's so amazing what people can do.
Going up
there
level.
Was one reason for me also doing the gladiatura. I'm not a very crafty person. I can knit a little bit, but that's it. And that's a very modern hand.
Oh, you could knit a helmet.
Yes. And I didn't had any much interest in all these handcrafts or whatsoever, because I have two left hands for that.
Yeah, so. Fair.
And that's like the typical women thing, that they are doing a lot of things with wool, like spinning and these things.
Yeah.
And that's what usually the majority of women do.
The reenactment.
And indeed learned a little bit through this reenactment hobby was indeed sewing.
So, nice.
With hand and also with the machine. Some people say, oh, for reenactment, no, don't use a machine. Everything needs to be sewed by hand. And I say, I don't have the time.
Ain't nobody got time
if
for that.
I can sew it with the machine. No one will see it. And only what is visible, of course, I do it with hand.
Yeah.
But assuming that people back then whose job it was to sew something, a tailor, not doing anything else.
Yeah.
And doing it, his stitches, his or her stitches were so precise.
Yeah.
Than my machine today. And they could do it much quicker than I as a whatever.
Yeah.
These things. So, yeah.
And there was a really interesting chat about that in the reenactment working group of Exarch at some point, about like how authentic in quotes, like, do you need to be as a reenactor? And I feel like a lot of people, you know, don't want to get involved because they think they do have to get completely immersed and like do it all themselves. But I mean, you were just saying there's lots of places where you can buy things or you can get stuff made for you So I think it sounds like it's just a nice place to have fun as well.
Yes, that is actually one thing. I'm involved in a project of reenactment handbook, and there they made a very nice table that they try to create this also three-dimensional. Even if you are accurate, how accurate can you be?
Yeah.
Like, for example, I do it with when I sew clothes, those seams which you don't see, I do it with the machine.
Yeah.
Other people who want to be more accurate, they do it with everything by hand.
Yeah.
And then they also use the correct thread. Even I use the modern one. If you put it in a machine, it needs to be this modern thread. But you don't see it. So and there you can be, even if you try to be accurate, you can also go be more and more and more accurate.
Yeah.
In the end, you sew everything by hand with the correct thread.
Yeah.
Then you can go also, oh, I need to spin all the thread myself.
Yeah.
And these things. Oh, I have to. And then in the end, if you go very, very deep, oh, I have to hold some sheep.
Yeah,
to
exactly.
get the wool, which I spin.
But I can only feed them what would have been provided at the time. And I can only eat this thing because then that requires
something
time.
Like yeah. this. Yeah.
yeah.
So
yeah.
It
you can always go deeper.
There could be different levels. And
yeah.
I say at least it should look from the way it looks authentic. Like we have the issue, yeah, with the breastband. How was it wrapped really? Because there was no instruction.
Yeah.
And also this loincloth, which the gladiators wore, the subigaculum.
Yeah.
We don't know how it really was draped.
Yeah.
There are now from the Berlin Gladiator Group, they tried now to find out how to drape this thing from a rectangular cloth. Because back then, it was most of the time, everything was a rectangular cloth of different sizes.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't afford it, like putting all this work in it really to produce cloth.
Yeah.
To cut away things like we nowadays do when we buy some cloth, the material, and then we cut away things and cut them together. And no, back then, especially the Roman clothing was... Everything was more or less rectangular.
Okay.
That was also a thing. I always thought the way I was wearing the supplicaculum, it just looked right, but I knew it was wrong.
Yeah.
But of course, because I didn't have any background in tailoring or something, I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
And one of them has like kind of a background as a tailor.
Yeah.
So that helped, of course, to figure out how to do this.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a kind of the mix, the collaboration between different sort of experiences in different aspects of the life, I guess,
yeah.
which is a nice
and
thing
I
with
think
those groups.
It's good to... I always shared my knowledge, and that's why maybe I will also share the knowledge with wrapping the...
Yeah, definitely.
Sorry.
I mean, I didn't know.
to wrap the thing, maybe putting it on an Exarch block, but I don't know when I will have time to write this.
That's fair enough. That's fair enough. But no, but that's really fascinating. And I mean, I guess one thing, because you were talking about, you know, do research and stuff, and I feel like, and you were saying as well yourself, you didn't start with kind of the academic background in archaeology and history. So I guess access to resources can sometimes be a bit of an issue. Do you find that either those involved with academia or sort of resources, academic resources, are quite accessible? Like, are people happy to share that sort of knowledge with reenactors in that way?
What I notice is now with those pages like Academia Edu, there are more things uploaded than in the beginning when I started that. And in the beginning, it was for me really hard to sometimes to get access to certain articles, which I found in the literary list of literature at the end of whatever books about gladiators and these things, which I wanted to read. But luckily, I got some in the beginning help from some academic people who were happy even still to make a Xerox copy of it and posting it to me, so still with his name because back then even it wasn't that popular just to scan in something.
So
times changed in these 20 years and nowadays these things are more accessible, and also that's why I'm writing on a book about female gladiators, and that's why I hope they are still interested when I submit the proof chapters, the trial chapters, that I will have a publisher who also works a lot with open access.
Nice, nice, yeah. But that's, because I feel like that's also important for reenactors a lot of the time, is you want to have, like you say, that authenticity, you want it to be accurate information that you're depicting. So that's why open access is so important indeed.
Yeah, well, or also, having a good network maybe of some people who are working at a university. So sometimes I'm asking them for really weird things, which I come across in those literature lists.
But it's indeed, and that's also what I quite like about, we've mentioned Exarch a lot, but that's also how Svenja and I know each other. So that's why we've been mentioning it a lot. But also in the Exarch Discord, especially the textiles channel, the working group, there's a lot of times people will request and be like, does anyone have access to this particular thing? And someone will be like, like, yes, I have it. What do you need? And, you know, or can you like share page 30 with me, or, you know, and stuff. And so I think, yeah, never be afraid to ask for resources and to try and find people who can help you, which I think, yeah, especially with this sort of thing. Well, I think we've come to the end of this particular tea break. I need to go and start stretching so that I can do my Palos exercises with my short sword. Before we get to that, Svenja, do you have any exciting, I guess, events or sort of other plans that are coming up, considering that this is going to be released in January? And how can people find you if they want to learn more about your work and your projects?
Yeah, I stopped now fighting actively as a gladiatrix. My Ludus will have next year the 20th anniversary. So I will be there, of course, as an honorary guest.
Exciting.
But yeah, the place and time is not confirmed yet. Otherwise, I'm more now focusing more on the theoretical part. Yeah. Which is usually people do it the other way around. But I started with the practical part, fighting actively. And now, yeah, putting this experience, which I have, maybe presenting it. And I put in a proposal of a paper for the REC Track conference next year in May. Mm-hmm. But up to now, now in November, I haven't heard back if it was accepted or not. So I don't know if that
will cross our fingers.
And then, yeah, of course, the already mentioned book on female gladiators. I want to pursue with that. Yeah. And
yeah, nice.
And also you got me some ideas writing a blog for XR.
I mean, I like giving people more work to do, as you can tell. And if they want to follow your work, say we've already mentioned academia, is there anywhere else where they can follow
you? Yes, Instagram. I also have an Instagram account, and I assume you will put those two links in the show notes.
Yes, right? I will indeed. Well, thank you so much, Svenja, for joining me today. It was really great to have you on to chat.
Yeah, it was nice having me.
And I hope that everyone listening enjoyed this tea break. If you did, please, as always, do like, follow, subscribe, and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Also, if you want to find out more about ancient history and all kinds of fun archaeological stuff, make sure to follow other shows on the APN. And if you want to learn more about the topic of today's episode or about Svenja's work, you can find all of the links, all of the contact information in the show notes. Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.